This begins a series of 10 one-hour studies of the Bible. The entire Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament, the Christian Scriptures or the New Testament. And it's very evident to everyone here, I'm sure, that it's impossible to cover so much in so brief a time span other than to set these extraordinary and remarkable documents, the most influential in the Western world certainly, into context, share a bit of what they have to say, explore their origins, and then presumably tempt you to search and explore them for yourselves. The Bible is the most read book, perhaps the least understood, the most owned, and in that sense also, to some extent, the least read. But even when students in the high school level study the Bible a bit, they come up with wonderful answers. I have a copy of a test given to high school students after a brief biblical survey course in which these were some of the answers given. Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a ball of fire by night. Moses went to the top of Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. Joshua led the Hebrews in the Battle of Jericho. And I could go on describing all kinds of misunderstandings of the Bible in terms of humor and that sort of thing, but it goes far beyond that in terms of the kinds of understanding we bring to the Bible and the sort of information we have about the Bible. Thomas Babington Macaulay wrote that the English Bible, for beauty and power, is surpassed by no other literature. It represents the best in Shakespearean language. Helen Keller, who had a deep religious experience, nonetheless wrote this about the Bible. There is much in the Bible against which every instinct of my being rebels, so much that I regret the necessity which has compelled me to read it through from the beginning to the end. I do not think the knowledge which I have gained of its history and sources altogether compensates me for the unpleasant details that were forced upon me in the process. You get all kinds of responses such as this, but my favorite goes to Mark Twain, who said, "Most people are bothered by those passages of Scripture they do not understand. I am bothered by those that I do understand." Now, what we're going to do in these next 10 sessions is cover the whole of the scriptural content. In this session, we're going to discuss briefly what the Bible is about, and then the book of Genesis, partly because it's the first book in the Bible, though not the first written by any means. In the next session, we're going to talk about Exodus in the Hebrew Scriptures under the theme of consciousness and the development of community. In the third session, we're going to talk about consciousness and memory, how the Hebrew peoples wrote history, history as storytelling. In the fourth session, we're going to talk about consciousness and cult, in which we're going to discuss the great prophets of Israel, or the Hebrew prophets, the literary prophets as referred to them. Theirs are the very first writings we have in the Hebrew Scriptures, beginning with Amos and continuing with others. The session after that, we're going to discuss clan, coterie, and creed, in which we're going to talk about the consciousness of boundaries and how the sense of identity was developed in ethnic terms and how that's had such an enormous impact upon subsequent cultural history, not to say biblical history. The session after that, we're going to talk about sage, saint, and sinner, or a development of cosmic consciousness within those who produced the Hebrew Scriptures. And finally, in terms of the Hebrew Scriptures, we're going to discuss in the session following that celestial foreign aid, or the notion that somehow we are incompetent of dealing with reality and there must be an invasion from another environment or another world or another level if we are going to be wholly what the divine intends. And then the last three sessions, we're going to deal with the Christian Scriptures. The first session, we're going to chronicle consciousness in terms of, is much of the New Testament history remembered, or is it prophecy historicized? The second session, we're going to talk about the consciousness of Jesus under that of the parable maker. And the third session on the New Testament or the Christian Scriptures, not the consciousness of Jesus, but our consciousness of Jesus under the theme of the myth and the man. Well, to begin this is to talk about the Bible itself and what it is and what it's not. And this does not represent the view of everyone. I do think it represents broadly a consensus of views found within the mainline Protestant and the mainline Catholic tradition, at least in this country. It does not represent a fundamentalist point of view, either within American Protestantism or world Protestantism on the one hand, nor in the elements of fundamentalism or heavy-handed traditionalism to be found in the Roman Catholic Church. But with that much of an introduction, let me talk a little bit about what the Bible is and what it's not. The first place, the Bible is not a book, it's a library. As a library, however, it is woven together of common themes and constant memory and the rediscovery or the renaissance of one theme or another again and again and again. And in that sense, of course, we can speak of it as a book. But it's much better to image the Bible as a library. Secondly, it's canonical. That is, it's the authorized literature of Judaism on the one hand, in the case of the Hebrew Scriptures, and of Christians in the case of both the Old Testament, as Christians have referred to it, and the New Testament. There is, however, and one must always remember this in dealing with the biblical materials, especially if you want to deal with them in anything like an historical or even scholarly manner, you must remember there's a vast range of non-canonical materials. Books that were written during the period in which the Hebrew Scriptures were being written, or during the period in which the Christian Scriptures were being written, which didn't make the cut, but which at the time, by one group or another, were considered to be authentic Scripture. That is, materials that were inspired in some way, rather uniquely, I'm sure they all would have said, inspired by God, and they would have viewed them as Scripture. But they didn't make the cut, so they are not canonical, but they give us enormous insight into what was happening in a comparable period historically or in the development of the literature that eventually was to become canonical. The Hebrew Scriptures, curiously, were not canonized formally in the patterns we have today until 90 of this common era. That is to say, the Hebrew Scriptures had not been formally canonized even in Jesus' time. Although the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures, Pentateuch sometimes as it's referred to in Protestant terms, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that was commonly accepted as official and in that sense broadly unofficially canonical, but as a canonical understanding of being the official literature of the Hebrew peoples, that did not occur until a council of rabbis at the seacoast town of Jamnia, in the year 90 of this common era. And the Christian Scriptures have gone through a strange experience in which one region of the church decided this group of books would be canonical or official. Another region said this group and perhaps another group of books, although much overlapping was to be. And in final terms, church-wide, universal, ecumenical, the Christian Scriptures were not in that sense formally canonized until the Council of Trent, which was a Roman Catholic council created in order to respond to the sudden eruption of Protestantism across the face of Europe. And Protestants have never had a time when a formal canonization process has taken place. We simply agree on the books we agree upon. They tend to be printed in the Bible. And in one sense, rather curiously, publishers sometimes determine what will be canonical in the informal sense of that word. And that's what we get when we buy a copy of the Bible. Now, the third thing to remember about the Bible in general is genre. It's of central importance to the use of the Bible since there is in the biblical materials, both the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian, a vast amount of material with different genre. That is, you have poetry, you have history or interpreted history, you have folklore, you have myth, political prophecy, letters, sermons, all kinds of different literature. And if you begin reading one part of the Bible and apply to it a consideration that would be appropriate for another genre, you may not only misunderstand that material rather dramatically, but you may abuse it very obviously. So genre is very important. What kind of material am I reading at this moment when I'm dipping into the Bible? Everyone knows, for example, the Psalms, being the hymn book of the Hebrew peoples, is essentially poetry. But many people are not as fully aware as they ought to be that practically all of the writings of the great 8th, 7th, 6th century before this common era, literary prophets, Amos, Micah, Hosea, Isaiah, practically all of their writings are in the form of poetry. And there's a reason for this. Number one, that's the best way you deal with oral tradition. Oral tradition is best passed on in poetic form. Everyone that is aware of this knows that he or she at one time or another has memorized a poem which he or she remembers far better than some prosaic statement that was made at one time or another. So vast portions, particularly of the Hebrew Scriptures, is in poetic form primarily because it came out of an oral culture. So genre is important when you are reading the Bible. What kind of material or what sort of literary point of view or methodology does this happen to be? The fourth thing to remember, and this represents a theological point of view, although one based upon reasonable attempts at responsible scholarship, you will not find a single viewpoint in the Bible, which will be illustrated in later presentations in this series, but you're going to find numerous viewpoints in the Bible on almost every subject. And I've said more than once over my good many years in biblical studies that if you'll tell me what you would like to believe and what kind of a denomination you would like to start, give me a little bit of time and I'll find something somewhere in the Bible that will give you justification and resource toward that end. Because you can find almost anything you want in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures if you'll cast aside everything else, focus intently on just that one point of view and go with it. But you're not going to find a single viewpoint in the Bible, and as I've said before, will be illustrated as we move along. The fifth consideration, in my view, quite pointedly, the Bible is not inerrant. That is to say, some biblical writers claim inspiration, though not all. Some biblical writers claim inspiration, but nowhere in the Hebrew or Christian scriptures will you find any notion recommending the notion of inerrancy or errorlessness. That's a view that has come into existence mostly in the last two centuries, mostly in Western Europe, and even more so in this country, and particularly on the lips of the evangelist, the traveling revival meeting enthusiast, the Bible as inerrant, pointing to itself as divine. Sixth point, the Bible is a book, if it's a book, or a library, preferably. But let me use the phrase, the Bible is a book written from the viewpoint of the loser. Can we have the first slide that covers this? Many people are not fully aware of this, but if you look at this brief chart here, you will notice that we have over here on the left-hand side approximate dates. This is before the Common Era, and then the Common Era begins, of course, down here with the ministry of Jesus. And these are the things that were happening within Hebrew or Jewish culture, and then, of course, in the time of the development of the New Testament. During these times, the dominant political force within the world at that time, the Eastern Mediterranean, is to be found described over here. The Jewish people were never part of a dominant, forceful political presence in the Middle East. They were tossed about by competing powers around them. Egypt, the Canaanites themselves at one time, the Philistines, from which we get the word Palestine, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Syrians, the Greeks, and then, of course, finally Rome. All during this period of time, the materials, the literary materials that are being produced that now we call the Bible, all of these materials are written essentially from within a context that represents a viewpoint of the loser in political, economic, social, national, ethnic terms. And that's important because most history is written from the viewpoint of the winner. Most history is written from the viewpoint of the winner. Here's one document that is quite remarkable for the fact that it's written from the viewpoint of the loser. And you need to keep that in mind because you're going to see an alternative vision of reality, which is exactly later on what you may find in reading about, discussing the teachings of a man named Jesus. Jesus was constantly producing for those listening to him an alternative vision of reality. And as you go through the Hebrew Scriptures, you're going to see a similar alternative vision of reality in the teachings of the wisdom literature as contrasted with the cultic literature within the Hebrew Scriptures. And when I use the word cult, I do not use it in a pejorative or negative or critical way. I use the word cult only to describe that pattern of behavior that describes this group of religious persons. Every religious group, every philosophical group, every people have a certain cultic apparatus representing their viewpoint of reality on the one hand, and then the way of their organizing, the way they organize themselves to deal with that particular viewpoint of reality. And most of the literature in the Hebrew Scriptures is cultic in orientation, reflecting a viewpoint of this people. But there's some material that represents an alternative vision of reality, just as the Bible in general represents an alternative vision of historical reality. And that alternative vision of that is that of the wisdom teachers in the Hebrew Scriptures, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, the Song of Solomon, and so forth. So that's point number six. The Bible is a book written from the viewpoint of the loser, and it's very good to remember that. Now, one other thing in looking at these dates, we date the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, somewhere around the 16th century before this common era, as you can see from this chart. We date Moses around 1290. To try to remember it, I say Moses is 1200, David is about 1000, and then his son Solomon, whose incredible incompetence as a political administrator and leader of his people brought about immediately upon his death a shattering of the unity of the Hebrew peoples into two groups, those of the north, 10 tribes, and those of the south, primarily the tribe of Judah and the Judeans. And until modern times, in Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, the Hebrew peoples were never again reunited. In other words, they stayed disunited through most of their political history from the time of Solomon on because of that. And then you go into the period of the prophets, and then the fall of Israel before Assyria, then eventually the fall of Judea in the south with Babylon and the celebrated Babylonian captivity. And finally, with Cyrus the Great, they are allowed to return home when he, head of the Persian Empire or the Iranian Empire, conquered most of the Middle East at that time. By the way, the first expression other than in Jewish or Hebrew terms of the phrase Messiah is applied to a Gentile by the name of Cyrus. He is referred to by the great prophet Isaiah as Cyrus, the anointed of God, the Messiah of God. Rather interesting, giving our understanding of Messiah in later centuries. So, this is history from the viewpoint of the loser. Now, point number seven, with some exceptions, the literary resources of the Hebrew Scriptures particularly move within this context of history. And if you don't understand something of this context, a large sweep of the materials you'll read in the Hebrew Scriptures particularly will be lost. Because as part of this, there is the development of the Hebrew cultural life, social life, political apparatus, and obviously religious understanding and perspective on reality. And point number eight, and finally in this regard, the Bible always and everywhere points beyond itself and not to itself. From my point of view or my perspective, the great tragedy in the last two centuries in American Protestantism in this country is that wide numbers of Christian people have pointed to the Bible as being the source of this or that, as being divine, as being inerrant. The Bible never points to itself really. It points beyond itself to some experience of the divine or of reality in the presence of God. It points beyond itself. It always brings to mind the experience we have with our little dog, a cockapoo, who is the would have been a great first baseman for the New York Yankees. He's really good at chasing balls. And you throw a ball to him, he goes for it, gets it in, invariably brings it back and drops it at your feet. But once in a while, if you throw the ball too far, he doesn't see where it's gone. And he looks back to me or my wife, and then you point to where the ball is, and guess what he looks at? Persistently and consistently, not where the ball is, but he looks to the pointing finger. And that's what we've done religiously with the Bible. It has been a pointer beyond itself to another reality, and we have tended to point to the pointer. We have tended to point to the pointing finger rather than that to which it points. And so, the Bible points beyond itself, not to itself, and when you begin to point to it, then you get all mixed up with literalisms, with historical presumptions of accuracy that may not be in fact accurate, and you get a form of fundamentalism or literalism that simply is not justified by the character of the materials themselves. Now, what about reading the Bible with these various introductory considerations in mind? Well, first of all, if you're going to read the Bible well, you need to put on the sandals of a person of the time in which it was written. In other words, let's say you're reading some of the parables of Jesus. You need to put on the sandals of a Jewish person in the first century of this common era and one who probably is of peasant background. And you need to hear the words that Jesus is speaking. Hear them more than read them as that person wearing sandals of the first century would have heard them. How would someone have heard or read this particular bit of information, whether it's in the Hebrew scriptures or in the Christian scriptures, how would a person at that time have really heard or understood or read these materials? For example, very quickly, Jesus has a parable. It's very familiar to everyone who knows Jesus' parables. The kingdom of God is like leaven. Well, if you're wearing first century Jewish sandals, you will know that throughout the entirety of your scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, the word leaven is never used otherwise than in one respect. It means corruption. So that on a holy day, what kind of bread do you have? You have unleavened bread, bread that is uncorrupted. Now, if you were wearing sandals of a first century Jewish person and Jesus had said to you, the kingdom of God is like leaven, what would you have heard? And what would you have understood? And what do you think Jesus would have been saying? Until you put on those sandals, you really are not prepared to understand what the Bible has to say. So that, the clue is this. Always ask first, not what does the Bible say, in whatever part of it, not what does the Bible say, but what did the Bible say? And as you begin to understand what did the Bible say, you may come to understand what it still may have to say in our time, in a totally different context, in a widely disparate culture, and so forth. Secondly, and we've already alluded to this as you read the Bible, be constantly aware of genre. What kind of literature is this you're reading? Thirdly, remember the canonical question. Some books didn't make the cut that maybe you ought to give some consideration to that are outside the biblical materials, but be aware that all of the materials you're reading within the Bible made the cut because they were officially approved of by the officials. And the officials are not always as right as the officials think they are, by which you may make that discovery in dealing with Washington, D.C. And the fourth thing is, do remember the translation problem and get a copy of the Bible. Get a copy of the Bible that fits your needs, fits your understanding. I don't care to make an explicit recommendation at this moment, but be aware that in translating materials from the Hebrew language or the Greek language, in a very few instances the Aramaic language, into English, you are moving not only across culture, you are moving across centuries, and you are moving into linguistic forms that don't work the same. I used to speak a little Spanish with some degree of facility and discovered that aphorisms, clever sayings, proverbial sayings, and especially humor, these things do not move well between languages. And until you begin to understand this, you begin to understand how difficult it is to translate materials written centuries ago in another language and another culture into the English language. Most of the Bibles today being translated by competent scholars are tending to use a technique of translation we call that of dynamic equivalency. Rather than translating words, we now tend to try to translate ideas that are being expressed so that as you read this passage or hear this passage, you are likely to hear it or read it in a way very similar to those who first heard it or first read it, rather than just to hear the words translated, which may not express the meaning or the feeling tone or the atmosphere as it originally was at all. Well, having spoken then of dynamic equivalency as a way of translation, as a way of understanding the way of moving from Hebrew or Greek into English, the only better thing that you can do is become a Hebrew and Greek scholar and do it for yourself. However, other than that, let's now move to the book of Genesis. Why do we start out discussing the book of Genesis in this first one-hour segment when we should spend hours on the book of Genesis? Well, we begin with Genesis because it's the first book in the Bible, but it was by no means the first book to be written that is found in the Bible. In fact, Genesis in the form we today have it probably wasn't put together until about the year 400. I'd like the outline of Genesis now on the board, if we can have it. Genesis, as a document, is composed of primordial time, prehistorical time, and an attitude toward time that we need to understand. Here are, on the far left, the way the Hebrew Bible is put together, the middle of the way the Protestant Bible is put together, and on the right, the date in written form that the various books in the Hebrew Scriptures were written as we today have them. Some of them went through a long period of redaction. The word redaction in scholarly terms merely means an editor has come along and reshaped the materials or added to them or deleted from them, redacted them into their present form. And so you can see the earliest written documents we have in the Bible are the great literary prophets of the 8th century, Amos, Hosea, Micah, 1st Isaiah. Then we have further prophets in the 7th century and further prophets still and the beginnings of the historical writings in the 6th century. But the 6th century is 4 or 5 or 6 centuries after the fact, 2 or 3 times the length of time that the United States has existed as a country before their primary historical documents got into written form. And then finally, you see them coming down into the 5th century, and the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, or the Pentateuch, however you wish to refer to it, wasn't put together in its present form probably until about the year 400, or in other words, during the time when the Hebrew peoples, or at least their leaders, were in exile in Babylon. Now, there's probably a reason why the Torah, that is the central core of the Hebrew Scriptures and the holiest part of the Holy Bible from a Jewish point of view, why it was not written till 400. We'll put up here in a moment another way of understanding this, but for the moment, remember that if the Torah was redacted, that is, editorialized, folded together in its final form in the year 400, or at the time of the Babylonian captivity, something profoundly political and spiritual was being said. Because Genesis begins with the idea there is one God that creates the whole universe. And this would have been contrary to all patterns of political, religious, and social thought of the era out of which the biblical materials came. Because when you were conquered by a foreign country, Babylon, for example, this means that Babylon's god, Marduk, must be stronger and more influential than your god, Yahweh. In consequence of which, when whoever it was that redacted the final form of Torah said, in the beginning, God, their God, the Hebrew God, he was making a political statement deliberately aimed at Marduk and the Babylonians by saying, it doesn't matter that we lost the war, our God is still God and theirs is not. A very profound political statement and the beginnings of the kind of characteristic stubbornness and resistance to tyranny which has characterized the Hebrew peoples ever since and the Jewish people as well as their followers. So that the Torah doesn't come into existence until very late. We're still, however, beginning right now with the book of Genesis because it is the first book in the Bible. And it also has 3 different kinds of history in it. It has primordial history. And now I'd like the next slide here. But before seeing what it has in it, let me tell you how the Torah was probably put together. Most scholars would view a chart like this or one something like this in this form with these dates. If you'll notice on the left-hand side, we have dates going back to about 1100, 1200, and then coming down to the year 400. And the book of Genesis, as well as the Torah in its entirety, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, to a lesser extent Deuteronomy, by the way, began to be developed into traditions like this. You have a nomadic tradition that is an oral tradition for a long while, then got into written forms. Then you have groundwork for a J tradition. We call it the J tradition because there, in that tradition, the word for God is Yahweh. J-H-W-H in the Hebrew, and we insert vowels because the Hebrew language didn't have vowels, and we're not sure exactly what vowels should be inserted. In the late 19th century, they inserted 3 vowels rather than 2 and ended up with Jehovah. But we think the word was probably pronounced Yahweh. We can't be sure because no Jew has pronounced this word for over 2,000 years. It's such a holy word that when you come to it in the reading of the Hebrew Scriptures in the temple, you speak the word Adonai or Lord, not God, because there's only one really good way not to take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Don't use it at all. So it hasn't been used, the word Yahweh, for 2,000 and more years. But that tradition is the J tradition. Then an oral tradition went on, and the J tradition was probably put in its written form around 1,000 or 900. Then there's another E tradition in which the name for God is El or Elohim, which is a broader context. That word was used throughout the Middle East. That tradition uses this broader generic phrase for God, not Yahweh. Very different tradition, written in a different style, reflecting a different point of view even. And then somewhere around 690, 700, these three traditions that had become written were conflated together by a redactor. But they weren't put together with one section added to another section added to another section. They were pulled apart so they fitted the whole story because each of them had overlapping stories, and they were folded together exactly as you would fold together a deck of cards. So to pull them apart, you have to pull them apart as you would a deck of cards if you want to get the spades, the hearts, the clubs, and what's left? Diamonds. If you want to get them apart, you have to pull them apart this way. They're not put together in this other way. So those three get together. Then we call that a J.E. tradition. Then, much later, comes the tradition of Deuteronomy. It's a book written almost in its entirety during the period of the great King Josiah as a single book. It gets added together then in about 550, that tradition in written form, and then you have J.E.D. Finally, somewhere around 500, you have a priestly tradition added. We call that the P tradition, because of priestly. It represents sort of the official viewpoint, the nihil olsta, the imprimatur, you see, of a tradition. And then finally, about 400, probably during the period of the Babylonian captivity, as already suggested, all these traditions are conflated together by a final redactor or editor, and like a deck of cards, they've been folded together, and now you have one single document, J-E-P-D, with the R being for the redactor, and you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But Deuteronomy primarily is a single book. That's the way it came into existence, and we can pull these strands apart and see them rather clearly if we wish to. We have all kinds of evidence of this sort of multiple authorship. There are irregularities, there are contradictions, there are many duplications in the Torah, the very same passage written or told twice within the Torah. We have twice telling of the same incident, but described in very differing ways. And through this long period of transmission, we know that whoever the redactors were, and we obviously do not know who they were, whoever the redactors or editors were, they played an enormous part in putting this together in the form in which we now have it. Thus, when we deal with this part of biblical history, the Torah, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, we are dealing with history and other materials that has long, long since been interpreted by redactors or by editors. If you read a biography of FDR written by a devout Democrat and another of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, written by a similarly devout Republican, you will have two rather drastically different portraits of the very same man. And if you're not cognizant of genre, background, culture, context, you will have to conclude, in fact, there were two different men with exactly the same name, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that's what you get often when you're dealing with biblical materials, because these materials are interpreted materials. And then, as part of illustrating this, it is to remember the importance of orality, storytelling, in the development of the scriptures. Into the New Testament, because Jesus was an oral person. It's important in the development of tradition. For example, you can illustrate this importance by the fact that in storytelling, you usually tell stories in terms of threes. Go to Jesus' parables. Usually there are three persons or three events. We have discovered in psychological studies just in the last 20 years that people remember in patterns of three better than they do patterns of one, two, or four. Very interesting. And here, our ancient friends had discovered this centuries ago, that you remember better in threes. Throughout the Bible, you have patterns of three. You know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I could go on all through the scriptures. We'll talk about that a little later. Also, the use of poetry represents oral tradition. As I've already suggested, poetry is more easily remembered as an oral phenomenon and passed on than is prose. And that's exactly why you find so much poetry. Practically all of the prophets are written in poetry. But of course, when you apply literalisms to non-prosaic and poetic materials, guess what you end up with? Confusion of yourself. Also, in the Bible, there are a great amount of repetition. Storytelling techniques amongst primitive peoples, by the way, not just the Jewish people. We find this, for example, amongst the Aborigines in Australia, reflect exactly these same discoveries of the nature of oral tradition. That is, patterns of three, poetry, repetition, the form storytelling takes, and that type of thing. So this must be a universal awareness of human consciousness at its most rudimentary. Now, a couple of observations about the book of Genesis when we begin it. Now, let's go to the next section on Genesis in its entirety. Two things. I want to talk about truth and myth in connection with the book of Genesis, because the first portion of Genesis is myth, basically. It's a form of truth that moderns have difficulty dealing with. Chapters 1 through chapters 11 deal with what we call basically primordial time. That is, time before time even began, in which you have the creation story, you have the story of the Garden of Eden, the story of Cain and Abel, the story of the flood, you have the Table of Nations in primordial time, and then, of course, you have the Tower of Babel. Well, all of these are in the realm of what we call primordial time. This is myth time or storytelling time. It's found in all ancient peoples. And so we need to have an understanding of both truth and myth as we deal with these ancient biblical materials. First of all, about truth. How do you tell the truth? Well, there are many ways to tell the truth. We moderns tend to think of truth as being historical and therefore accurate. Well, even the history that we read about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln isn't all that accurate. It has been fed through redactors, editorialists, storytellers, and so forth. The way the ancient biblical peoples and other peoples similarly of that time told the truth was by interpreted history, but much more importantly, by folklore, by myth, or in Jesus' time, by parable, how you tell the truth. Pablo Picasso, the great artist of our century, once said, "Art is a lie to tell the truth." And what he meant by this was very simply, you see a painting and you say, "What a beautiful mountain." It's not a mountain at all. It's a piece of canvas. It's attached to a frame, and it's splashed with whatever it may be. Oil, for example, if it's an oil painting. It's just daubs of oil on a canvas. It's not a mountain. So if you say that's a mountain, that's a lie. But it's a lie to tell the truth. I never understood the truth of the heavens until I was grasped by the great painting of Vincent van Gogh's called Starry Night. Some of you must be acquainted with that great painting, this great blue background. I used to go out as a teenager, look up into the heavens, and I became so quiet and so relaxed and so peaceful and so meditative because it was so serene and so quiet and so peaceful and so wonderful. And then one day I saw Vincent van Gogh's painting, The Starry Night, and here is a painting exploding with energy. Vital in every part, great stars coming into being, bursts and explosions of light, stars whirling around in space. And I suddenly began to realize, when I as well read a scientific textbook, that when I went out under the night sky, I was not looking up at peace and serenity and quiet and meditation. I was looking at a veritable explosion of vitality and energy. And I've never looked at the night sky differently again. The art of Van Gogh was a lie. It wasn't the night sky that told me the truth. Now, that's what we have to remember about storytelling. And therefore, myth must be understood in those terms. Myth, you never ask of a myth like the story of the Garden of Eden or the story of the first murder in history, Cain and Abel, or the story of the Tower of Babel, or of the flood. You never ask of a myth, is this true or false? Because that is an inappropriate, inaccurate, and inconsequential question to ask of a myth. You only ask of a myth one question. Is it living or is it dead? That is, as an explanation for reality or as a visiting of reality in words and portrayals and colorful pictures and so forth. Does it reflect how we understand reality and live in that reality, or has it become dead, irrelevant, uninteresting, unuseful, and unused? You only ask of a myth one question: is it living or is it dead? So, with that understanding of myth and of truth, we need to then look at the book of Genesis itself. There are, of course, two creation stories in the beginnings of the book of Genesis, the first chapter and most of the second chapter. The first couple of verses of the second chapter are really part of the first chapter, and it was divided up wrongly way back in the time of the past, particularly in the period of King James, which many Christians refer to as the St. James Bible. And James was about as far from being canonical, either in being ordained a saint or in behaving like one. But we have two creation stories. Many of the stories of Genesis gain immeasurably in clarity and power when we separate them into their sources rather than read them artificially as one continuous narrative that has been put together by the redactor. And I hope I've explained that sufficiently so that that's perceptive right from the beginning. If you separate the first chapter from the second chapter, you begin to see you have two entirely different stories of creation. One of them is by the E author, and the other by the J author, to whom we have earlier alluded. Now, the first chapter of Genesis was probably written very late by the E author. The second chapter, the J chapter, remember, Yahweh is one and Elohim the other, word for God. The second chapter was written very much earlier, hence a more primitive account. And in the second chapter, of course, we have a fascinating story, a humorous one, really. This begins the humor in the Bible, if there is humor in the Bible, and I'm most assured there is. God, in the second chapter, creates man. And I don't mean humans, I mean a man, a male man. And then he tries to find a suitable mate for this man called Adam. Now, where did he look? I don't know. Did he look at the giraffe or the ocelot or the kangaroo? But at last, he finally discovers somebody that's suitable for a man, and he calls this person a woman. It's a very tender story because presumably she's taken from his body, you know, the rib account. And I remember my kids in their early adolescence kept counting their ribs to be sure that one was missing and one really isn't. But at any rate, it's a very tender story if you see it in primitive terms, because what the second chapter is about is a primitive understanding in a male-dominated, hierarchical, patriarchal culture, but nonetheless one that said woman was taken from the very body of man, and in treating her, he must remember he's treating her because she's part of himself. And so in that primitive way, it's a rather fascinating story. It represents the origins of patriarchy, the role that men played and women did not play. But we must remember that even in the biblical tradition, in Genesis, you know how it goes, and for this reason a man shall forsake his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That's what the second chapter of Genesis is about. And that's why ancestry in the past, or what will become ancestry in posterity, is always traced only through one line, the woman's. Man becomes unimportant in Hebrew or Jewish society. If you have a Jewish mother, you can have automatic citizenship in Israel today. If you have a Jewish father and a Gentile mother, not so. It goes through the mother's line, indicating something of the primitive structure of that society. The first chapter of Genesis is very much different, very sophisticated. God does not create a man in the beginning. He creates the order, he creates the world in a very orderly fashion, and at last, in one single stroke, he creates Hadam, meaning really humankind, male and female, reads the account, created he them. So in the first chapter, they're created at the very same moment, co-equal. In the second chapter, a very much more primitive form in a very different way. And the final redaction of these two chapters, the editorializing and putting them together, as we've already suggested, occurred undoubtedly during the period of Babylonian captivity, when this was not just myth revisited and worked out together in a constructive, creative, imaginative way, but was a powerful political and religious statement against the god Marduk and against the Babylonian people and the period of captivity in general. The Garden of Eden. Well, the Garden of Eden is about tending the garden. Everybody images the Garden of Eden as absolutely an idyllic area. I always image the Garden of Eden mythologically in my mind when I visit the San Diego Zoo. I don't think Eden could have been any better than the San Diego Zoo. But remember that both in the San Diego Zoo and in the mythological Garden of Eden, there is a snake in the grass. And the whole idea of going back to a golden era doesn't quite fit the Hebrews' way of thinking. There are certain golden eras to which they go back. You'll see this later when they treat the period of David as being a golden era. But always there's a snake in the grass, and remember all the gaudy things that even King David did. But in the Garden of Eden, there is the forbidden fruit. Now, we don't know everything that this has to do about it, everything that this deals with in terms of the understandings of the time. But we do know that in the story of the Garden of Eden, they are moving toward a kind of self-consciousness. And this is the beginning of an adventure in consciousness that goes all through the way through the biblical tradition. They'll be moving into self-consciousness. And the key for most people has been, aha, Adam and Eve sinned and they were thrown out of the garden. But that's really not the way the story goes. According to the story, the snake begins to be persuasive to Eve. Eve then is persuasive to Adam. Adam picks the fruit and they're thrown out of the garden. Not quite. They're not thrown out of the garden because they've sinned, at least as I read the story. They're not thrown out of the garden even because they've picked the fruit, the forbidden fruit, which John Milton called an apple, but there's nothing apple about it. Having grown up in Southern California, I'm perfectly sure it was an orange. But whatever it may have been, that's not when they're thrown out of the Garden of Eden. They're thrown out of the Garden of Eden when this mythological conversation takes place between God and Adam and Eve, and it goes something like this. What have you done? Well, what we've done is we ate the forbidden fruit. Why did you do this? Well, Adam says, the woman talked me into it. And then the woman says to God, hey, wait a minute. The snake talked me into it. Now, that's why the snake crawls and doesn't stand upright anymore, according to mythological legend, which doesn't seem altogether biologically accurate. But nonetheless, it's certainly mythologically appropriate. The point of the story is their fellowship with God is not interrupted as a result of their sin. Their fellowship with God, according to this wonderful mythological story, is interrupted when they will not take responsibility in consciousness for what they've done. And when they cease to take responsibility, they're out of the garden. And so we have sort of an interesting way of exploring an ancient idea here. There's the story of Cain and Abel. Fascinating story, because here begins a tradition that will spill out and run through the entirety of the scriptures, both Hebrew and Christian, Old and New Testaments, in that the younger son always gets the better of the deal, although in this case it's a bit of a problem. But the younger child is always looked at more favorably. Go through the entirety of the Hebrew scripture right down to the time of Jesus, and guess what story from Jesus' parables comes forth? It's the story of the parable of the prodigal. And who is treated with gentleness and tenderness, and for whom the fatted calf is killed, and who's given his inheritance and all this stuff? It's the younger child. And all throughout the Hebrew scriptures, we'll point this out as we go along, it's the younger that always achieves precedence over the older. This probably comes out of an historical event in which the Hebrews arrived at the land of Canaan, which would later be called Palestine and today is called Israel. The Hebrews arrived in the land of Canaan, and they were the younger brother to the older, pre-existing older brother, the Canaanites. And so they were probably always, always aware of the younger, older relationship. I have a member of the Sioux tribe who is president of an educational institution in Arizona who says, you know, we always talk about the promised land and the Hebrews coming and taking over from the Canaanites. I've always been interested, said this Native American, in the viewpoint of the Canaanites. Then we have the great mythological story of the flood. That kind of a mythological story is found throughout all of the Middle East. It's probably taken from an older Gilgamesh epic. There's the 40 days rain and so forth. Well, 40 now becomes a number that is dealt with throughout the rest of the scriptures. Elijah goes to a cave for 40 days. Jesus is tempted in the wilderness for 40 days. And of course, the supreme event in Jewish memory, for 40 years, the children of Israel wander in the desert. Why? Because 40 is the symbol of rebirth, re-energizing, a new way of looking at the world. 40 is the time when, and of course, in terms of the wilderness wanderings, the point for Moses is we've got to keep the people in the desert 40 years so that a whole generation with a slave mentality coming out of Egypt will die off. And we may have a new generation that does not have that slave mentality and will be free persons to enter the Holy Land and live it as free men and women and not with a slave mentality. The story of the Tower of Babel. Here's a threat to the gods in the ancient world in which the humans try to storm heaven. As my friend Mark Twain, my favorite theologian, puts it, heaven opens by grace. If it went by merit, you would stay out and your dog would go in. So the Tower of Babel is a kind of an ancient illustration of this whole concept. Well, here we're dealing with all of these stories are primordial history before time began. Then we move, and we don't have time to go into it in detail, into prehistory. The stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchal fathers, marvelous stories. They ought to be read in great detail, but they are prehistory because we don't think they represent exact history at all, but the kind of remembrance that occurs of ancient stories as we want to remember them. But two things must be said about this. One thing about heroes, and one thing about the writings themselves of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. On heroes and saints. A person becomes a hero or a saint in the biblical tradition not because he or she is good, but because he or she gives to the people of his or her time hope. David was not very good, but he gave his people hope, vitality, and energy. And even today we speak of Martin Luther King as having had some flawed aspects to his personality. Why is he a hero or saint, particularly to the black community still? Because he gave his people, not goodness, but hope. Heroes are made by giving people hope, not by giving them goodness. Now, that doesn't mean I am against goodness. It merely puts in perspective how reality deals. And the other thing that I must say in concluding this section about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the remarkable thing about the redactors of the Genesis stories is their consciousness. They tell the whole story. They include the good with the bad, make their heroes very human, don't see the opponent as an enemy, only as a fellow human. These writers have a generosity of spirit that always embraces the perspective of the unchosen, the defeated, and the despised. And in fact, if you read it carefully, there are no villains in Genesis. For example, the unfavored brother can indeed, as in the meeting of Jacob and Esau, be portrayed as more sympathetic and morally better than the one who turns out to be the hero. This generosity of spirit, which does not see people in terms of good and bad, us and them, is a rare and remarkable quality of mind that should always be emotionally moving any time you pick up and read this remarkable opening book of the Hebrew Scriptures that we call Genesis.